Hi, Ethan.
Hi, Bob.
How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good. Let me introduce us. I am Robert Wright of Blogging Hits TV. You are Ethan Zuckerman, known for a number of things. You are director of the Center for Civic Media at MIT. You're author of the book Rewire, and you have just written a piece that a lot of people are talking about for The Atlantic, called The Internet's Original Sin, in which you decry the advertising-based model of internet revenue and attribute to it a number of social ills and talk about some alternatives to it. But before we get into that, Ethan, I have to say that before reading this piece, I had no idea how much you have to atone for. And I think maybe you know what I'm talking about.
You know,
Maybe not.
it's interesting, Bob, because my confession in this piece was basically a parenthetical, and it's something that I've said before. I've been on the record about this for a long time, but I am one of the people who helped bring the pop-up ad to life.
Thank you for that. Ethan, on behalf of America and the world, I'd like to thank you for the pop-up ad.
Thank you is not what most people have been saying when they've
It's
been
not what I
reacting to this.
mean
I
either.
will say it is one of the more interesting aspects of the last week. I put out this, what I thought was a very serious sort of argument about the corrosive effects of surveillance on American society. And we managed to have about 20 hours of conversation about that. And then CNN Money wrote a piece titled Inventor of Pop-Up Ad Apologizes. And since then, I've been getting, you know, 5 or 10 requests a day for interviews asking me for public atonement. I'm also getting threats in many different languages, threats
Really?
from Croatian to Brazilian Portuguese, demanding that I do something. I mean, essentially
Like
assuming
retract the invention.
what someone said, I think this person probably had Chinese as their native language, was, "It is your Frankenstein monster, only you can kill it." And I wish that were actually true. I wish that, you know, having put a pop-up ad on a user's webpage on tripod.com in late 1996, that I somehow magically had the code that I could just launch on the web and sort of undo it all. But that's really not how these things work. So I sh certainly didn't expect that that would be the takeaway from this article. But that does seem to be the first thing that everybody wants to talk
No,
about.
you're right. And we will spend most of the time talking about the more substantive parts of the article, including this kind of connection between the advertising-based model and surveillance. But first, I have to say, I was a little surprised by what the original rationale of the pop-up ad was. I had thought it was invented just so it could dominate your screen and shove advertising down your throat as forcefully as possible, but that is not why it was invented, right?
Yeah, not in the least. So let me sort of set the scene for you. This is late 1996. I think at this point, the VP of research and development for a company called Tripod.com. Tripod is one of the top 20 firms on the web at that point. And the reason we have so much traffic is that we are hosting web pages for millions of users. And this is a business we got into almost by accident. We thought we were going to be a content site. We thought we would be providing content for college students to figure out how to navigate their post-college life. But a feature that one of my programmers, a guy named Jeff Vanderkloot, had put on the site late one night ended up dominating our entire business. And something like 95% of the traffic we were serving was on user web pages. We knew we had to find some way to recover the cost. So we started putting ads on user web pages, and this was pretty standard at the time. Our main competitor, GeoCities, was doing the same thing. We then got a call from an advertiser who had found an ad for his car company on an obscene page. And it was a page that we shouldn't be hosting, and we ended up deleting the
Well, more
page.
specifically, it was a page celebrating anal sex, right?
Photographically celebrating anal sex.
Yeah, and I'm not aware of any car companies who have used that as a theme. I mean, you could, you know, I mean, a backseat, I guess, well, anyway, but.
People have argued for a while that Subaru was looking for the lesbian market, but I'm guessing that this auto company did not really want to be associated with gay porn, which they were in that case. And So my boss came to me and sort of said, look, we've got all of these homepages. We know that we have to put advertising on them. We also know that we can't review all these web pages. Not only can we not physically do it, but we are worried under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that if we did review them, we would then be responsible for all of their content. So we need some way to sort of distance the ad from the page. And what I decided to do was invent something that I was calling the navigation console. So when we opened the home page, we would open a second little window, and in that window would be tools to sort of surf through different tripod pages and find our content and edit and update your page, and also a little ad. And we were doing this as a 200 by 200 square ad in either a horizontal or a vertical window. And I thought it was pretty elegant. I thought it was pretty cool. It was actually something that let you know that you were on tripod. It gave you a couple of functions, and it also incidentally gave you an ad. We put it up. There was no big reaction to it. In about a week and a half, GeoCities had put up a much simpler one. It just had GeoCities branding and an ad in it, no real navigation. I looked at their source code. It looks like they were using the very simple snippet of JavaScript I'd written to do it. So we joked
Interesting.
for a while that they had
But
just cut.
I guess you feel that information wants to be free, right? So what's the difference?
It wasn't a choice at that point, Bob. These were back in the days of everything being
Oops.
written into the HTML. No one was obfuscating their code, and we weren't exactly going to, go sue our competitor over cutting and pasting a snippet of code. That seemed like an absurd thing to do. But yeah, I think very quickly the idea of a pop-up ad became normal. It certainly became normal on our site. Subsequent designers stripped out all of the navigation function, and very quickly all we had was a little bit of tripod branding and then an ad within those windows. But as I said in the essay, the intentions were good. The hope was to make it possible for people to have homepages for free on the internet, and that was something we were actually quite committed to. We had a lot of people who weren't going to be able to pay even $5 a month to have a voice online, and we wanted to make it possible for them to share their thoughts, their experiences, their news. And advertising was at that point really the only way that we knew how to finance it. So I felt, pretty decent about it at the time. Obviously, I didn't realize we were going to get flooded with these things, that pop-up blocking would become a cat and mouse arms race. It was very hard to sort of anticipate all of that happening. And I hate pop-ups as much as the rest of us. I don't have any sort of twinge of pride when I see one. I'm just as miserable as the rest of you.
Although, the kind of ad that really should incur the death penalty for whoever invented it is the one where not only does it trigger, you load the page and you get a video complete with audio track without asking for it, but there is a delay. Such that after you've got several tabs open, suddenly one of them starts talking and you don't know which one it is. If I find the person who invented that.
The stealth delayed pop under. So one of the things I think is worth sort of considering in all of this is the tendency towards blame, right? So like I said, my life has been pretty surreal lately. I woke up on Friday morning to discover that Jimmy Fallon had used me as the opening joke in his nightly
Excellent.
monologue. And
Excellent. Congratulations.
well, I this is not a major achievement in my life. I have to say, of all the things I'd like to be remembered for, being a Jimmy Fallon punchline is really not one of them. But it has gotten me sort of thinking about this question of why is it so important to have someone to blame? And I think part of it is that things like the internet and the way the internet works seem so sort of big and impossible to influence that it's really nice when you can kind of look at it and say, oh yeah, that guy, like that's the guy who is making my life miserable. It's all Ethan's fault. We wouldn't have pop-ups without him. And of course the answer is obviously you would. It was a really easy JavaScript trick, and probably GeoCities would have done it 2 weeks after us otherwise. But being able to sort of identify the single avatar for what you hate about something is in some ways very empowering. And I'm wondering if there's like a positive version of it, which essentially says, if we really believe that sort of one person was enough to screw this up and break this, is there a way in which one person or a small group of people could take on something and fix this? And this was really what I was trying to get at in this piece, sort of looking at this idea that advertising has become the default business model on the web.
Right.
And sort of raising what seems like an almost impossible idea for some, that maybe that isn't the way that it has to be. Maybe there are other ways to go about this, and maybe this isn't even the least bad solution. It was perhaps the least bad solution when we first put it out there, but there might be significantly less bad solutions at this point in the game.
Okay. And before we get to the alternatives, you mentioned several things you don't like about the advertising model. And first we should say, you know, there is a defense to be made of it. I mean, just as you said that advertising seemed like a way to allow people who couldn't otherwise afford it to create web pages, well, advertising is a way for people to see without charge, you know, all kinds of interesting and maybe edifying information in principle. But there are a number of kind of bad things you attribute to the advertising model. And I suspect that the one you're most concerned about is the one you lead with, the one you talk about first. And that is the connection with what you call surveillance, or certainly at a minimum, the kind of aggressive gathering of private information about people.
Yep. So first of all, let me sort of clarify a little bit. My jihad is not against online advertising as a whole. I actually think that there are aspects of online advertising that are pretty helpful. And what I would say is it's the distinction between the yellow pages and television. The internet does the yellow pages surprisingly well. When you open up the yellow pages and you're looking for a plumber because your sink is overflowing, there are the free listings and there are the paid listings. And in some cases, the paid listings are just as helpful, and they're actually a helpful signal. Here is someone who is a plumber and who is looking for business and is in fact so much looking for business that they're willing to spend some money to attract you as a new customer. So I think that sort of transactional ads, ads that are getting you in the process of search, sort of ads on, you know, the right column of Google, that doesn't worry me all that much. What does worry me is advertising that's trying to use the internet as television, which is to say the way that television works is television says, we're going to give you content that you want. In exchange for 22 minutes of content that you want, we're going to give you 8 minutes of content that you don't want. And it's a tough bargain, but it was the bargain that we bought into in the age of broadcast. We're far less willing to buy into it now in the age of cable and the age of TiVo. And in fact, most of us have found one way around it or another. And on the internet, we just don't buy it at all. And ads are something that people actively avoid or sort of only click those display ads when they've made an error and they actually can't figure out how to get them to go away. We're looking at things like a 0.2% click-through rate, and it basically suggests that, you know, people are effective at avoiding those ads, you know, 499 out of 500 times.
Right.
It's fully conceivable that the only clicks that you're getting are either people who made an error and clicked by accident or click fraud. So the system doesn't work. And I think everyone knows the system doesn't work, but we have to keep persuading venture capitalists that businesses are somehow going to make money. And so you have new startups essentially saying, look, we're going to make money two ways. We're both going to produce ads that are more effective than any other display ads out there. And we're going to get there by learning an enormous amount about the people using our site. We're going to be very aggressive about collecting and collating information. And we're going to use that to do terrific psychographic targeting to those users. And also, we're going to treat that data as an asset, and we're going to sell it off to other brokers. And this has become so standard, so stock, as far as a VC pitch, I had a friend come to me earlier today. She is manufacturing medical devices. She's manufacturing medical devices for the developing world. And one of the problems that she's having with her VCs is that her VCs want this to be a data play. They really want her to redesign her device. So what they're getting is marketing data on cholera patients. And this is just crazy. This is broken. It has very little to do with what the data is actually worth. It's a story we're telling ourselves. It's
a myth. And your contention, so in other words, not many people are actually making it work economically that you gather enough data about people to serve them ads they actually want to see and then also sell the information and so on. The business model is not actually working, you're saying, except as a way to fool investors into kind of thinking that it could work or will work someday. But your view is that it really won't work someday. Am I right in that inference?
Yes. And so my exhibit for this would be Facebook, right? So Facebook is the biggest site in the world in terms of attention minutes, in terms of capturing human attention. Mm-hmm. It's the biggest game in town. And yet, Facebook is only able to monetize our attention at a very, very low cost. So if you look at Facebook's cost of running a site and serving ads, if you look at their revenue and their profits, if you break it up in terms of how many users there are at Facebook and how long those users spend on the site, it looks like your attention as a Facebook user is worth about a penny an hour to Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
That's crazy. The fact that over the course of an hour, Facebook is going to show you many, many ads, and that collectively those ads are worth a penny of profit. And then you sort of look at this and you say, it's not like Facebook is shy about collecting demographic data on you. Facebook knows your age, your location, where you went to school, your gender, whether you're married or not. They know your social network. They know what you claim to like. They have an incredibly rich demographic and psychographic profile of you. And yet, that seems to be worth a penny an hour.
And the ads never seem to, and this is really true of the web generally, they rarely seem to be tailored to my actual interests in a very sophisticated way. I mean, in Facebook, the only ads on Facebook that ever even tempt me to click on them are pictures of scantily clad women. And the only demographic information you'd need to know about me to serve those ads to me are that I'm male and heterosexual. Mm-hmm. And Facebook has a lot more than that. And for that matter, the banner ads I get elsewhere on the web, a very common thing is that it'll show me something from a product category where I made a purchase weeks ago after researching it. But hey, I already bought the wristwatch, okay? I don't want a wristwatch. I won't need another wristwatch for like 10 years.
Yep.
And so this just seems to be very crude use of information about.
We're terrible at this. We are dreadful at this. And it's possible that folks like Jeff Jarvis are right. And Jeff's reassurance on this is no. It's really early. We're just in the first innings. You'll love advertising once it becomes germane and relevant to you. And I just think he's wrong. I don't think I'm ever going to love display advertising. I think I may love really well-targeted germane ads while I'm searching for something. When I go to Google and I say I'm looking for a wristwatch, getting a really thoughtful, well-targeted wristwatch ad might not be a bad thing. But when I'm on Facebook trying to write to a friend expressing my sympathy for the death of her mother, or when I'm writing an email to one of my students who's having a hard time with a class and Gmail wants me to click on something, you are demanding my attention at a moment when I don't want to give it to you. So I don't think we're ever going to love these things. But the second thing that I'm much more worried about, and this is really me building on a great essay by a terrific thinker and programmer, Moshe Shiglowski. And Moshe argues that if you are running a venture-backed startup, you're not really selling ads. What you're selling is an investor story time. And investor story time is I have to tell my investor that my ad inventory and my users are going to be worth so vastly more than anybody else out there. And that's why they should invest in me, because I'll do it better than Facebook. Mm-hmm. And the fact that Facebook is so bad at it actually makes investor story time a little bit easier. If Facebook was doing a great job of targeting ads, right, it would be hard to make the case that you were somehow going to do better. But because Facebook is so bad at it, it's not hard to sort of stand up and say, there's got to be a better way to do this. And Mache correctly suggests that what everybody is doing is trying to put more and more information into this. They're trying to link more aspects of your online behavior. They're trying to get a more thorough profile by correlating between different cookies. We're starting to see advertising that is trying to figure out your path through the physical world. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of companies that are putting Wi-Fi nodes in shopping malls, because your phone will naturally, as you walk through the mall, just connect to whatever node you happen to walk past. And by taking the device identifier of your phone, just your Wi-Fi ID, they're able to start building a profile, and then they can figure out how to target ads to that profile. And then if you happen to go and log on to a service while you're using that Wi-Fi, they then link it to that profile, and they can now say, oh, not only is Ethan a 41-year-old white man, but he walks past this store 3 times a week. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's time to send him a coupon. And, you know, perhaps that's going to get a 0.3% click rate rather than a 0.2% click rate. But in the process, we've gotten everyone very used to this notion that if you're doing something online, you have to expect that you're paying for it by being surveilled at all times. And that's right. What really worries me.
And that is your main worry. There are other things you talk about in the article. And I think there's some cases where I'd be inclined to argue that the problem you're talking about doesn't have maybe as much to do with advertising as you seem to think. I mean, one effect is the so-called filter bubble or echo chamber, you know, where we kind of surround ourselves with information and people that's congenial to the worldview we already have. And I would think that a lot of that has to do with just kind of the known tendency of people to affiliate with people who have comparable perspectives, the tendency of people to surround themselves with evidence that confirms their pre-existing worldview. So, I mean, you do think the filter bubble, I assume, would be something of a problem without advertising, but or maybe I'm wrong about that, but in any event, you think advertising somehow reinforces the effect, right?
Well, so a couple of things. I love Eli Pariser. I think
he wrote the book, The Filter Bubble.
Incredibly good at branding. What he means by the filter bubble and the way that we've all started using the term are actually quite different things. What you're really talking about is what Cass Sunstein calls the echo chamber, and the tendency of us to get surrounded at all times by content that we agree with. The filter bubble is sort of Eli's twist on this, where he basically says, here's how Facebook makes it worse. They use an algorithm to sort of target and personalize to you. And here's where my argument sort of comes in. The reason that Facebook wants to personalize to you is both because they think you'll have a better user experience, but also because it's a great chance to shake you down for personal and demographic information. Mm-hmm. When you personalize a news feed, you're giving a lot of very valuable information about who you are and what you're looking for. And I think the incentive to personalize media is really coming again from investor story time. It's coming again from the sense of, if we just know everything about the user right. looking at our ad, we'll make the ad more meaningful. So I am concerned about personalization as a whole. I wrote my own book on this topic, Rewire, which sort of looks a little bit beyond what Cass Sunstein is talking about with the echo chamber and what Eli's talking about with the filter bubble, and sort of suggests that this is more than just left-right politics in the U.S. It's really about us, them on a global scale. And that tendency to self-affiliate, that tendency towards homophily, is at least as powerful and profound in terms of Americans versus the rest of the world. Not only am I likely to hang out with other New England Democrats, but I'm at least as likely to hang out with Americans as I am with non-Americans, and that has its own set of problems. But no, I mean, my real worry in this is the normalization of surveillance. And what it really comes right. down to for me is, I think like a lot of people, I was surprised and shocked post-Snowden, not so much at the Snowden revelations. It was confirmation of what a lot of the internet's most paranoid citizens had worried about for a very, very long time. What I was shocked at was how divisive a figure Snowden was. And I was really surprised at how many people saw Snowden as a traitor, as a dangerous individual, and how many people seemed to feel like regularized surveillance was just the way that the world worked. And I think some of this is America post 9/11 and the idea that terror trumps all other concerns. But I really do feel like a big part of this is that having trained everyone to understand that whatever they do online is public behavior, could come out to haunt them, and at the very least will be used to target ads to them, that to me strikes me as just a norms change in society that's potentially extremely dangerous and that I don't think we've thought through the implications of carefully enough.
Okay, so that's your main motivation for wanting an alternative to the advertising model. You talk about a couple of alternatives. Probably the main one it seems to me the one you take most seriously is the kind of, you know, the subscription model, whatever you want to call it, where people actually pay to get content. That is famous as having in many cases not worked all that well. In some cases it has worked okay, but it's known to be challenging to make certainly, you know, the variant of it known as a paywall work, right? Mm-hmm. But you see some glimmers of success.
Well, so it's interesting. This article has clearly struck more of a chord with news people than it has with, in some ways, the intended audience, which was software developers. So I think subscriptions may be able to work for some types of news content. I do pay for the New York Times. I pay for a whole lot of different podcasts in one fashion or another. I would draw something of a distinction between a subscription economy and a donation economy. And I actually think we probably need to take the donation economy a lot more seriously. What I think a lot of podcasts have done extremely well is said, look, we know we're not going to get everyone to pay for this. We're going to ask you to do more than your fair share because you love this and you want it going out to other people. And I would say that, you know, when I get that call from This American Life or from Welcome to Night Vale, two podcasts that I am a regular donor to, I do my best to step up and honor it, in part because I think the philanthropic model in some ways is a healthier model than the pure subscription model. I think the model of you can't have the New York Times if you happen to have the quite a bit of money to pay for it is sort of less helpful than in some ways saying, we'd really like you to pay for this, and in the process, we're going to try to make it free because we think it's an incredibly valuable public service. But mm-hmm. put that to aside, because that really wasn't in some ways where I was going. What I was going for in a very real way was, could I have Facebook without the ads and without having my data sold? And what would it cost Facebook to do it? And would it be worth it to me as a consumer? Mm-hmm. And the answer for me personally is on Facebook, nah, probably not. I'm not a heavy user there. I'm not a big fan of how the community works. I maintain a presence because old high school friends maintain a presence.
But you'd probably pay a penny an hour, which would get them to the break-even point, apparently, right?
I mean, well, so that's the funny thing, right? So for Twitter, which I'm a heavily...
Yeah, I would pay for Twitter. I would pay for Twitter.
Well, so here's the thing. Like, I'm not going to assume that Twitter is somehow fantastically a better revenue-generating engine than Facebook. Right? If we can agree on that. Mm-hmm. And so if Twitter is making a penny an hour off of me, and they probably aren't even making a penny an hour off of me, and I showed up and I said, hey, Twitter, 10 bucks a year, I'm in. Is that a good deal for them? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, if you're actually talking about real revenue now, The answer might be yeah, probably is. Particularly if you still have the option to be a free Twitter user and be under whatever sort of scrutiny and whatever sort of data capture you're currently under, but charge for the premium services. The most obvious for this is Gmail, which I already pay for, where I pay for storage, but would be thrilled to get some sort of auditable security guarantee that says that Google can't read my mail, either the good old-fashioned way of reading it or read it algorithmically to target me ads. And some way of sort of reviewing that, that would be very, very interesting, and something that I could potentially imagine paying for. And so where I really wanted to start to go on that was, could we have an I'd pay for Twitter movement? Could we have an I'd pay for Gmail movement? And I think the answer is that those companies might respond by saying no, and that they are still imagining some sort of a mythical upside from having all that data, and just sort of assuming that one of these days they're going to emerge with the data profile so perfect that no advertiser can resist. But I really am fascinated by folks like Mache, who runs a service called Pinboard, where I signed up for the service for $5 3 years ago. He hasn't asked me for a penny subsequently.
And that's like a, is that a, that's a bookmark sharing thing where kind of like on Twitter, you wind up being led to things you want to read by what other people in the network want to read. Is that it?
What it really was a replacement for Delicious. So many of us relied on Delicious as a bookmarking service. And bookmarking turns out to be one of these things that people get pretty emotional about. If you've kept your bookmarks of everything that you've read on the web, and then suddenly Delicious gets sold to Yahoo and it doesn't work the way that you wanted it to anymore, you really do feel very trapped. And so Mache sort of made a very explicit promise. I'm going to let you in for a very low price. I'm not going to hold your data. You can export it at any time. He's now trying an upsell on top of it, where for $25 a year, he will not only take all of your bookmarks, but he will actually archive any page you link to. So if I think something out there on the web is really interesting and important and I bookmark it, he will also store a full copy of that page. And that's a really interesting service. And what he says is, look, I've been profitable since day one on this. I'm charging a level that allows me to offer the service and to do it on the moral grounds and tenets that I want to do it with. Now, he, in fairness, he is not doing this as VC backed. He doesn't have to play investor story time, but he's sort of living proof that there is another example, another model for how to do this.
Yeah, but there is a question I have about this, which is that all the examples, we've said we would pay for Twitter. I know a lot of people would pay for Facebook. This Pinboard thing apparently people will pay for. You mentioned Reddit Gold, which is kind of a premium Reddit service that liberates you from ads. Fine, but all these services, these are not immediate content providers. Well, you could argue about Facebook, but a primary function of these services is to either lead you to content produced by other, by content, original content providers, or to help you archive it or something else. And that only happens if there is content in the first place. So, people get led to Atlantic pieces via Facebook and Twitter, and for that reason, they might pay for Facebook and Twitter. But what about the Atlantic itself? It has to, so that's, and that's where I think the most trouble has been encountered in trying to make a subscription service work, right?
Well, I think that's right. And I think that given the incredible diversity of what's out there, having everybody run their own subscription service is probably not the way to go. So again, I'm going to go back to the podcast world because this is a world where there's an incredible amount of creativity going on right now, and people are actually finding some very interesting ways to get paid. Most high-quality podcasts are putting out one show of between, let's say, 15 minutes and an hour once a week. And that's kind of a low level of content at which to get someone to subscribe. So you're starting to see some of these guys band together in networks, and they're doing cross promotion and they're doing cross support. And the idea is, I really like 99% Invisible. And they're part of a network called Radiotopia. And so I give to Radiotopia to support 99% Invisible. And in the process, I'm supporting Ben Walker's Theory of Everything, which also happens to be a terrific podcast. And so there's a whole chunk of content at that point that I can suddenly feel very good as a donor for having supported, and I'm more likely to sort of pay some attention to. So I think some combination of networks, of subscription, and possibly moving more towards the, look, this is not that we're putting up a hard paywall, but it is that, you know, you're spending a lot of time on our site, and we'd really like you to step up and help us out with it. To me, that seems like a more plausible way to go. The other thing that I ended up suggesting in the piece, and this is not a new suggestion, anything, it's a 30 or 40 year old suggestion, is that at some point we may need to find some way to deal with micropayment.
Right.
And again,
which is for people who don't know the term, it's like I write this piece on Slate or some lesser platform, but the point is I get a very small amount of money, like a penny per person who reads it, and they're fine with that. And one of the problems with that is the transaction costs. Well, there are a lot of problems. But anyway, what is your I've long had high hopes for that, but they've faded. So cheer me up.
So there's a ton of problems. And I think it's one of those ideas that because it has failed so miserably in the past, people are actually sort of afraid to pursue it again. But there's a couple of things to think about. One is that if micropayments are not so much about, you know, getting a penny each time you look at a page, but instead are sort of giving you an awareness of where you're spending your time and asking you to sort of allocate your money. So some of the systems that essentially say, what is it worth to you to have good content on the internet? You know, are you willing to spend 10 bucks a month supporting the content providers that you care about? You know, that's an amount that I would feel comfortable with. It's probably too high for some. It's probably too low for others. Having a tool that simply keeps track of where you spend your time, where you spend your attention, and then essentially allocates a donation at the end of that would be one interesting way of sort of thinking about micropayment. So if I spend an hour a month on Blogging Heads TV, you get some share of that 10 bucks that I'm putting up. If most of the content that I read happens to be in the New York Times, then we go over to the New York Times. And by the way, I reference the New York Times because I've looked at data from some link sharing services, and you would be astounded by how much of the content shared comes from that admirable site. So I totally understand why they feel the need to firewall. But I think sites like The Atlantic and The New York Times actually might benefit a great deal from that. So that's one that actually doesn't need a transaction cost. That just requires you to sort of put yourself under a bit of watchful surveillance and then essentially report or self-report that information. It's also possible that as we start getting into different forms of currencies, that the micropayment problem gets a little bit easier. The reason the micropayment problem is so hard at the end of the day is that right now, if we try to process a payment to a Visa or a MasterCard, you end up paying a minimum of 28 cents and then about 3% of the transaction.
Oh, is that right? A minimum of 28 cents.
That's right. So
that answers my question, just not to interrupt you for too long, but I had always wondered why. You know, why doesn't Amazon.com turn itself into the key payment service so that you would read the first paragraph of a piece and it says, if you want to read the rest of this, pay 10 cents and all we need is your Amazon account, because that, you know, they've got so many people's credit card information. But you've answered the question. Well, and so now proceed with the solution.
Sure. So actually, let's play with that for a moment. If you buy things from the iTunes store, you may notice that you do a transaction, you buy a song for 99 cents, and you don't immediately get an invoice for it. And the reason that that happens is that Apple is desperately hoping that you will do three or four more transactions in the next
before you realize.
Hours. Well, or just so that they can bundle them together and clear
I see.
$5 charge on your credit card. Any time in the real world that you've gone to the coffee shop and it says $5 minimum for credit cards, this is why.
Well, Amazon could do that, right?
Sure, they could. They could essentially, I mean, for one thing, they could do it with Prime, where they know that you're going to make purchases over time. and that they could essentially allow you to run a tab for a while. So micropayments work if you let a user run a tab, and micropayments could also work if you get to much lower transaction costs. And one of the reasons, probably the only real reason I'm interested in cryptocurrencies, is that in theory, you should be able to get to fairly low transaction costs on them. Actually, not on Bitcoin. Bitcoin is badly broken, and can actually only handle a very small volume of transactions, and those transactions are.
Although this is the case that Marc Andreessen has made for Bitcoin as an investment, is a lot of it is about the vanishing transaction cost, right?
Yeah, I for all the things that Mark is both right and wrong about, I think this is one where, from what I understand from people who've looked very closely at the innards of Bitcoin, it's pretty darn expensive to process a transaction. And the system is capped at a surprisingly small number of simultaneous transactions. But whether it's Bitcoin or whether it's a subsequent cryptocurrency, we're now starting to get to the possibility where we sort of say, does this really have to cost about a quarter of a transaction? What if this cost, a hundredth of a cent a transaction? That really starts changing the playing field, because the difference between a quarter a page and a tenth of a cent for a page might be a very different system. All that said, I'm still not a sort of hardcore, yeah, let's lock down the web, we'll pay for every page we see. I actually think some combination of subscriptions, donations, micropayments, and possibly, less horrible ads, transactional ads. I think it's pretty interesting what the ad block folks are trying to do with ethical advertising, where they're trying to do advertising that agrees that it won't track you. I think at least it's a step in the right direction. I worry that it may ultimately be doomed, because I do think that advertising as a whole is based around this idea that we're trying to capture your attention when you're doing something else. And it's just not a transaction that people want to engage in. It's one that we do out of necessity, not that we do because we're particularly satisfied with it.
Yeah. No, I think if anything, people more and more resist having their attention yanked away from them by various things because it's become such a problem generally in the modern world. And it's just an annoyance. But well, listen, this has been very illuminating. So much so that I personally am willing to forgive you for having brought us the pop-up ad, Ethan. So I think you're well on the way to atonement.
Well, I appreciate that. It's a great weight off my shoulders, and I have to say, I feel better every time I tell people about it. So,
Yeah,
thank you for your
well,
forgiveness, Bob.
I know you lie awake at night worrying about what I think of you, but so you can sleep easy now.
As so many of us do.
Not enough. Okay, thanks a lot, Ethan.
My pleasure. Always good to talk with you, Bob.
Yeah, same here.
Take care.